welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research, their international networks, their aims and plans for the future. I shall also be hearing from staff and students about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. This is the programme that keeps you informed about what's happening on campus. I'm pleased to have with me in the studio today on University Matters, Dr. Rafael Vella. Dr. Vella is a senior lecturer and coordinator of the art education programmes in the Department of Arts and Languages in Education at the Faculty of Education here at the University. He obtained a PhD in Fine Arts at the University of the Arts in London in 2006, with a thesis entitled The Unpresentable, Artistic Biblioclasm and the Sublime, focusing on the philosopher Léotard's writings on sublime, the sublime, art, religion and related areas like the book and indoctrination. Prior to obtaining his PhD, he studied art education at the University of Malta and also obtained a master's degree, specialising in aesthetic education. He's published numerous articles and catalogue essays about contemporary art, an artist's book called Book in 2003, a book about his drawings in 2008, Reading Cabinets, and was editor of On Art and Art Education in Malta in 2007. He's curated several exhibitions with work by Maltese and international artists, as well as exhibitions of children's art. His work as an artist has been exhibited internationally, and he's also presented a number of papers in international conferences and peer-reviewed journals. Earlier this year, he was invited to have a solo exhibition of his recent work in Germany, in Brilon, near Frankfurt in Germany, about which we shall be speaking, and we shall also be speaking about another upcoming exhibition which he's going to be involved in. I know Dr. Vella is a very enthusiastic lecturer with wonderfully talented students, so I hope we shall also be speaking about that side of his work. Welcome, Dr. Vella.
Thank you, Tricia.
Let's start by talking about the exhibition in Germany, and then we'll move on to the one that's coming up at the end of May. This was titled Untimely Meditations. So how did this all happen?
Well, it started through a contact I had in Germany who was a friend of the curator in this museum, and he showed her some of my work and she was kind of intrigued. And that's how the kind of invitation came into being. The title itself, you know, this is always a problem. What kind of title to give to an exhibition sometimes?
Should you have to give it a title at all, one asks?
Exactly. And I decided, okay, let me do something which sounds a bit bombastic, perhaps. You know, Untimely Meditations is a famous collection of essays by Nietzsche, the German philosopher. And there was a kind of Nietzsche link in one of the works, which was the biggest work I'm showing there. And also the fact that this was in Germany, so I decided to go for it. The museum itself, which is it's a very old house actually in the center of this small town. Brilon is quite a small town, but with a medieval core and a very beautiful town square. And the museum is a kind of big mansion in this town square. So this is where all the activities in the town take place. And it's a museum which is mostly kind of dedicated to the history of the town and the surroundings. It's not specialized in a specific field like art, for example, but so you will find, for instance, in the basement something that children there are excited about. You will find dinosaur bones that were found in the area, bones of an iguanodon, this big dinosaur. And then obviously other things that are related to the history of the house itself. But they keep a kind of ongoing presence of contemporary art, and so they have mainly German artists who are invited there on a regular basis. Some of the rooms are kept deliberately vacant to kind of allow for these interventions within the museum space. And that's where I came in. I had a number of rooms which were allocated to my exhibition, I believe about six rooms, so it's quite big. And I tried to create a kind of sequence, a concept within the whole museum, which would lead you from one room to the next. One thing which I did was I asked them from beforehand to try to find some old classroom furniture from the area.
Yes, I wondered about that because I saw the picture on the web. Yes. And I thought, is that classroom furniture part of an installation?
Yes, yes. That picture on the web was actually a picture which of an installation which I had done here in Malta and Valletta at St. James Cavalier. And I kind of recreated it to a certain extent in Brilon in Germany.
But what were you trying to...
Well, the installation is called Medical School, and I had these old medical books, which were no longer in use because they're quite old and no longer sort of kind of obsolete academically. But what I found was really interesting about them is the way they kind of dictate how we understand ourselves, how we understand our own bodies, the parameters of our understanding of the self. And I kind of subdivided these books into three groups, which became three rooms in the museum in Germany. One group kind of refers to newborn babies and how newborn babies are defined and categorized scientifically. Another one, where another section where books are referring to public health, again kind of referring to how we should live our lives and how we should relate to the different objects we use on a daily basis. For example, bathrooms. How should an ideal bathroom be created so that it's not an unhealthy experience? Water fountains, swimming pools, drainage systems, everything, you know, everything that kind of relates to the way your body interacts with the environment. And then I had another sector of these books, which then became the final room in this medical school installation, which referred to death. And forensics in particular, photos and different explanations of a dead body found, for example, in mysterious circumstances. It could be murder, it could be suicide, and so on and so forth. So basically it was birth, life, and death. And in the middle section, which referred to life, I deliberately only chose pictures which did not include any human beings. It was just... you know, like things like swimming pools and water fountains and bidets and toilets and things which we surround ourselves with. So I wanted these classrooms, which I recreated using furniture, classroom furniture they got me themselves in Germany, to make it seem like, you know, this is the way we kind of teach our own children and, you know, the future generations about birth, life and death. And the images themselves were kind of photographed from the books and then transferred using a system. It's a technique in art known as image transfer. And then anyway, I can't explain the whole technique, but it was image transfer plus collage and so on.
Were you able to wander around the rooms incognito with any viewers, or didn't you have that opportunity?
No, I really didn't have that opportunity because, as I said, the town is quite small, so I kind of became known sort of pretty quickly.
So it was obvious who you were.
Yes, yes.
Because I think it would be interesting for an artist to be listening to the reactions.
I probably wouldn't. I don't speak German myself, so I that was a
that
bit
might
of
be
a,
that might be a problem. You also gave a lecture.
Yes. A talk. In a nearby city, it's called Gießen, the University of Gießen. I gave a paper. They have a kind of seminar with an invited guest speaker every semester. And since I was going there, they thought it would be a good idea to have me there as the guest speaker for this semester. And so I gave this paper about contemporary art and identity in art education to quite a good crowd, actually, not only of students and postgraduate students, but even professors of art education. I've worked with this university on a number of different projects, and in fact this paper was, in a sense, a result of that work. We've worked on quite a big EU-funded project, which was called Images and Identity, with six European universities. One of them was our university. The University of Gießen was also there. The leader was a university in London, Roehampton, and then there was the Czech Republic, Portugal and Ireland as well. And it was about how to deal with the whole issue of identity with children in class. It's a big issue. There are national identity, ethnic identity, gender identity, so many different aspects of identity. So what I did during this paper was basically I tried to relate different aspects of identity to a number of works I selected by contemporary artists that could also be used in an educational context.
And from Germany to the Biennale di Venezia, I hear.
Yes, it's happening in a few weeks' time. It's in end of May, the Biennale starts, and I've been invited by a group of curators who now for the last couple of editions of the Biennale have organized an important collateral event called Personal Structures, where they invite a group of artists who are really kind of central to the history of contemporary art. So, for instance, in this time round, there's going to be people like Gotthard Graupner. He's a famous German painter. Arnulf Reiner, he's an Austrian painter. Yoko Ono, John Lennon's obviously ex-wife, and then a number of artists from more marginal contexts. This is again a big problem within the world of contemporary art, is that when you start to realize, okay, who are the artists who are always visible, you'll find that they generally come from the richest and the most kind of central countries. So you have the USA, you have Germany, the UK being always top of the list. And so what these creators try to do is they try to bring together artists who are already at the center and artists who come from more kind of peripheral countries, and they try to bring them together in what is the most important exhibition on the planet, which is the Biennale di Venezia. And they have this exhibition at the Palazzo Bembo, which is a big palace right on the Canal Grande near the Rialto Bridge. So it is the kind of exposure it gets is quite
wonderful,
enormous.
Wonderful for you personally, but also wonderful for Malta that it should be represented
yes.
at the Biennale. About your own work, you're well known for sort of installation type works. These are not just paintings, and you do different things. Tell us something about what sort of pushes you as an artist to create these works.
Well, what pushes me, I guess, is a passion for creating in itself, and that is that comes first. That, in a sense, you don't really care about the language you're using to create as long as you're creating. So whether what you create is called an installation or a drawing or a painting or music or sound or whatever, doesn't really matter. The medium itself is an excuse to say something. What you say is what counts. I actually used to do more installations in the past. I still do once in a while. I mean, in Germany I had one or two pieces which I could actually call an installation. But they were also integrated with drawings, for example. So I'm kind of moving into more multimedia presentations now.
In fact, one of the hallmarks of many of your works really is this tactile feeling.
Yes.
About it. I can think of a couple. I was looking through your website yesterday.
Yeah.
and seeing some of these where you feel you want to get out and touch it, even if it's something that's hanging on the wall.
Yes, that's this kind of sculptural element, which I've always loved, the textural sort of, you know, feel of an object. And you get it a lot in some of the work I used to do, especially in the past. I used to work a lot with books.
Yes, that was something I wanted to mention, because it's the books was like a recurring theme, certainly in your earlier work. You really, perhaps it's maybe the academic side of you coming through into the creative part of you.
I guess so, yes, I guess you're right. And I've always loved books since I was a kid, for different reasons, not to tear them up and use them as artworks, to read
which
them.
Which you have done on several occasions.
Yes. But, you know, destroying the book is, in a sense, is a way of showing your love towards it as well, in its own very paradoxical way. But there's a difference, I guess, between, you know, destroying books for creative reasons and then destroying them for more kind of fundamentalist reasons, as often happens, you know, in dictatorships, for example.
Your books have been in the paper form, and you've made them into clay,
into pulp,
you've made them into metal, all sorts of manifestations of the book.
That is, in fact, the more a kind of tactile aspect, which you refer to yourself, when a book is torn into little pieces and then put in water, and then that becomes almost like a clay, which you can actually mold and make into a form. That gives the book a different thing, you know, a different feeling altogether. One of the most important changes that takes place is the fact that the text is no longer visible. So you have transformed the narrative, because the book is always a kind of narrative. There's a sequence to it. There's a first page and the last page. You have transformed that narrative into nothing. It's almost like taking everything back to square one. And that's always, yes, it's always been an issue for me. You know, the fact that knowledge very often is presented to us in a very sort of distinct and clear and fixed way. A book is that. Sometimes education in its worst forms could be that, indoctrination we normally call it, where it's fixed, you have to believe what is told to you. And what I try to do is, in a sense, is get rid of that, and perhaps going back to square one, to a very kind of bare slate to start afresh, that's a dream.
Some of your work, though, is what can be described as abstract. I mean, some of the pieces that you have are not, they're not figurative in, mm-hmm. in that sense. I noticed recently that the BBC presented a series on contemporary art, subtitled something like, So That We Shall Never Hear Again the Expression, I Could Have Done That Myself. And I found it very surprising that so many years after the advent of abstract art installations, the Turner Prize, the BBC still felt the need to subtitle a series on contemporary art in that way. Has abstract art not managed to reach a wide audience? What is it? What has gone wrong, or what hasn't happened?
No, it's the central question, I think, you know, related to art from the beginning of the 20th century onwards. I think what existed in the past, and by the past I mean before the end of the 19th century, is that art is generally dealt with subjects that were close to the community. And so, in a sense, the community always already knew the signs they were reading. It was that, like, they were just confirming what they already knew. So if you saw a painting in the Renaissance or the Baroque period, you instantly knew that, okay, so this is that saint, or this is Jesus, and this is Mary, and I know exactly what's going to happen next because you've read the Bible so many times. While what happened perhaps with the advent of modernism is that artists started to need a kind of interpreter. In fact, that's when art criticism became very important, towards the end of the 19th century. It already existed before, but not to the same extent. In the 20th century, it really exploded. It's almost like artists now needed this kind of intermediary to explain what was going on. And even the way we teach art changed, because I think now what we try to tell from the beginning of the 20th century onwards, what we try to tell our students, you know, rightly or wrongly, I have my doubts sometimes about it myself, is that, you know, you need to be original at all costs. But we know that when we're telling our students that, we also are telling them, look, you're going to lose the audience, or there's the potential that you will lose the audience. By being original, you're going to say something that the audience might not understand and might not even bother to stop. So there is this kind of internal paradox in recent art, where the artist is kind of urged to be new, and at the same time, the artist knows that by being new, there's always this possibility that this kind of connection won't take place. On the other hand, I think there's a lot of recent art, and by recent now I mean the last 15, 20 years, tries to, you know, somehow get across that gap by creating new links with the community. For example, by creating installations within the community where the community actually has to interact with the piece. And that is a possible first, you know, move in this kind of translation process. Okay, this is something which you can try to make sense of by actually interacting with the piece, and the piece is not complete if you don't interact with it.
Yes, because I suppose with a piece of abstract art, there is this feeling of sort of alienation and they move, yes. moving away and moving back and not. Whereas if they have something to do.
Yes.
That's why installation is so wonderful from that point of view.
Yes, which is why I prefer it to, I mean, with abstract art, I normally, you know, relate that to more, you know, abstract forms of painting and some forms of sculpture, mainly painting though. While installation, I feel, is less abstract in that sense, you know, like abstract art always had this issue of kind of avoiding the narrative, in a sense, no? Avoiding the story. There is no storyline there. It's not about religion, it's not about politics. So in a sense, it liberated artists. The artists didn't have to sort of, you know, be the servants of the state or the servants of the church and just telling the stories which other people told them to tell. So in that sense, I think abstract art was important. But now I think many artists are returning, in a way, to narrative, but it's a kind of combination of personal narrative with community-based narrative.
It's a wonderful subject. I've seen a couple of wonderful installations at Tate Modern, all about the tactile and people getting in touch with their bodies and things.
Yes,
which is
yes.
Great stuff. Yes. Great stuff. You mentioned your students. I think they're great. I mean, I've been involved with them only peripherally, of course, but for Discover University, you always very kindly get them really involved and do a lovely exhibition of their works. And I must say, some of the material they do is really, really good. I mean, I would have happily walked home with one or two of their pieces under my arm if I'd been able to.
Oh yes, I mean, the students for me are really what I, you know, it's what it's all about for me over here at the university. It's you know, they are the people who I most enjoy being with, I must admit, because, as you say, they are very creative, and in some cases they really kind of work beyond their call of duty to a certain extent, you know, like, as we all know, you know, a credit normally is something like 14 hours. In the world of art, that means absolutely nothing. And I tell them that from day one, you know, like, if you're choosing this subject, it's definitely not a soft option. You can't go away thinking that this is going to be enough, 14 hours. You will have to work a lot more. And many do. And they do spend a lot of time on their own in the studio, you know, between lectures or when they have free sessions. So I allow them to do that. They can go get the keys, go in the studio, work as much as they. And they can be very productive and very creative. They need to be helped, because as undergraduate students, normally, you know, it's not always a natural process. You know, they need to be guided, to be shown how other artists are already doing this, so that they can see, okay, I'm not kind of reinventing the wheel, and I want to do it in my own way, so perhaps I need to look elsewhere. But yes, I mean, definitely, you know, the working with the students within the university, and also the students in other contexts. I've worked sometimes with my students in schools as well. For example, during teaching practice, which is an important aspect of our course in the Faculty of Education, in the fourth year, I always get my students to put up an exhibition of students' work, of children's work. And now, after a few years have passed since we've been doing this, I've been getting really positive feedback from the heads of school, because it's, you know, it's a way of giving, of the university giving something back to society. We tend to, you know, take a lot. You know, we send our students there, they take up valuable time, resources of the schools. So I think as a university, we need to also be kind of, okay, proactive, let's give something back to the schools.
Mentioning resources, if you had a little wish list that you could draw up, what would you go for? Because some of the pieces that were there, they were their pottery pieces, clay needs to be fired, paints need to be bought, newish materials need to be ordered. Is that going all right? Are there things that you would
no.
like?
No, I mean,
how much time do we have?
No, I mean, that is the biggest headache, actually. You've touched upon a really sore point, because, I mean, facilities have always been the big problem here. We only have a small studio, a little kiln, where you can only kind of fire a few small pieces. So in most cases, if you've seen pottery by my students, it wasn't fired on campus. It was fired very often at the lecturer's own home, where he actually takes them and he teaches them there. So I really have to take this opportunity to thank my fellow lecturers, who very often take students into their own places. No, we really need to take this kind of, I think, very seriously, you know, that facilities for the arts need to have a place within the university. We need to start thinking more in terms of practical work being research. And if it is research, then if you have laboratories for chemistry, for example, then you need laboratories for art. It's the same kind of thing, but taken in a completely different direction.
Well, certainly we've been enjoying recently some wonderful artworks around campus, and that's something which I've been working here a very long time, and at the beginning I said, gosh, it'd be nice to have artworks on campus, and now we're beginning to see that. We've got bodies rising out of the soil, and we've had sweet wrappers hanging from the library the library walls. And I think that that really, that art side of the campus was lacking for several years, and now it's coming to life, and I think it's really given a quality leap to campus.
Thank you.
A last question, we've got a couple of minutes left. Artists sometimes spurn the academic because they're busy creating and doing their thing. You obviously haven't done that. You've managed to successfully marry your academic interests and that side of it with your creative side. How have you managed to do that, or has it just been okay and natural and fine, or do you find that you've sacrificed one side or the other at any time?
Oh yes, I mean, it's always this, for me personally, this is a very big issue, because you know, very often you end up spending a lot of time writing, and then I start getting very frustrated because I've been too long away from my studio, and my fingers start feeling very itchy, like I need to get to do something. But very often what I do is I work in spurts, like in different, so I take like 3 months where I only produce my art and very little else, and then 3 months where I work on my academia, and more or less it's managed to kind of, you know, I've managed to work in that way. But no, it's never easy. You always feel like you're torn between two worlds, and possibly, you know, using books and text in my own artwork has been a way of kind of bridging
the gap. That's what I thought. Well, thank you very, very much.
No, thank you.
Dr. Evo Vella, for coming to talk to us today about his art, his exhibitions, and about his students' work. And I wish you in bocca al lupo for your exhibition at the Biennale. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you for being with us on University Matters. You can listen to any of the previous interviews in this series on the Campus FM website. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.